Hey, ladies and gentlemen, this episode of Juan Epstein is brought to you by our friends at Loot Crate. Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and Juanito?
Yeah.
Good night. Say good night. Good night. It's Juan Ep time. Cypher Sounds is on baby duty, so he cannot be here, but a man who knows all about baby duty is John Legend.
I'm here.
What's happening, man?
Luna's dad. That's my name.
Luna's dad is in the building. Chrissy's husband. He's here. I'm excited to do this because, like, I've known you for a long time, always seen you around, always known how deep your history, like, you sort of live this interesting life of, like, you're a very, I don't want to say, like, crossover artist, like, that everyone knows in from every genre. You have older fans of all backgrounds, but you're also very tied to hip-hop, and your come-up was such a hip-hop.
Yeah, it was through a hip-hop foundation that I started my career, even though I grew up, you know, playing gospel music and soul music.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Ohio.
Where in Ohio?
Springfield, Ohio.
Which is near Cincinnati?
It's near Dayton and closer to Columbus than it is to Cincinnati.
Well, what's it like? What kind of area is it?
It's like a small city, 70,000 people. My dad was a factory worker, and the biggest employer in my town growing up was this auto factory that he worked for.
Yo, that is so Midwest.
It's like quintessential Midwest.
That's like straight out of Tommy Boy.
Yeah, like, he's like a true union worker. You know, he worked at the same job for 30 years, the whole thing.
What's your parents' ethnic background? Are both your parents black?
Both of them are black. They're both light-skinned, so they both have, you know, mixed background, you know, through the years. But
you had a quintessential black American
experience. All of their parents consider themselves black, too. So,
got it.
So we were all, you know, consider ourselves African-American, Midwest African-American.
What was the Midwest African-American experience in the 80s? What are you, 35, 36?
Yeah, I grew up, I'm 37. I was born in 78 and grew up in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, it was, like I said, my dad was a factory worker. We went to a kind of integrated school in Springfield. And, you know, it was, you know, a pretty mellow upbringing. It's not too crazy of a city, not too much violence, not too much, you know, just
very middle class.
We were lower middle class, I would say, like on the lower end of middle class. But yeah, I would say, like, we lived in a pretty safe neighborhood with other blue collar families around us. You know,
what were the in school? What was the racial makeup of school?
It was like 20% black, probably maybe a sixth to a fifth black.
And so, was your crowd an all black crowd?
No, it was mixed. I was in AP classes, so I was like one of maybe, if there's 20 kids in the class, there's probably three black kids in there, and you know, so my friend base was a lot of the black kids, because we were like the one black lunch table in my class, and most of them were like athletes or, you know, involved in sports in one way or another. And then I was always friends with the drama kids too, because I was doing musicals and stuff like that. I was friends with, you know, the artsy crew.
You were playing? Were you playing music in the musicals?
I was singing. Yeah, I was performing. And then I was also in student government too, so I was like student body president.
Oh, so your politics thing has always been.
Yeah, I was always like friends with everybody, cool with everybody, and I was student body president.
Oh, really?
And prom king.
Oh, so you were the man in school. Let's be clear.
I was like, you know, I was like, by the time I got to my senior year, I was pretty popular. And
did you have
I started young because my mom homeschooled us, and I started high school when I was 12. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So high school at 12 is crazy.
We were homeschooled during grade school, and I was like basically learning the same stuff my older brother was. So by the time I started going to regular school, my mom was like, you know, he's ahead of his peers. He needs to be skipped. And so I got skipped twice.
How does one even start high school at 12?
Yeah, it's weird. I was definitely like shy and.
Because 14-year-old boys already look young.
Yeah.
A 12-year-old boy looks like
young.
A baby.
I look super young. So I started when I was 12, and so it took me a while to warm up. But by the time I was a senior, I was pretty, like, engaged and popular around school. But when I first got there, I was just like, whoa.
So how did you do with girls in school, given that?
It took me a while to warm up, but I warmed up.
Because at 12, you can't.
Yeah.
Now who's messing with you?
Because girls don't even want guys their age, really.
Let alone.
In high school, let alone someone younger.
So you had to wait. So it took a little bit of time.
I had to, yeah, but I grew into it. I just had to sing. That's what I had to do.
They had to see that. They had to get the shows up.
Yeah, I was like, I got to sing more.
So where did the singing thing come from?
The family. The whole family sings.
But just for fun?
Yeah, just no one's like a professional, like no one's at this level. But I grew up around music. Everybody sang. Everybody played an instrument or did something. My dad sang and played the drums at my church. My mother was the choir director. My grandmother was the organist at church. And so I grew up just around music. I took piano lessons starting at 4.
They got you into it.
We had a piano in the house. I begged it because my brother was taking piano lessons and he wanted to quit and play the drums. And I was like, I want to take piano lessons. I begged them when I was 4 and they let me do it and I never stopped playing.
Wow. And so how quickly, at what age, I mean, you got homeschooled. This is interesting. At what age do they realize, okay, you could be really good. We need to like really reinforce this and push him.
Well, I was already playing and singing in church by the time I was 7 or 8, and I loved it. Like, I loved, like, performing for people. I loved the energy that I would get when people would respond to what I did. And so I pushed myself a lot because once you get that joy, some people love it, some people don't, but once you get that pick-me-up of the crowd loving what you do, it's kind of like you want to feel that again.
What kind of music were you listening to at the time, mid-80s?
It was mostly, I grew up in one of those houses where you weren't even supposed to listen to secular music, like, in the house.
Wow.
So we grew up really on a lot of gospel when I was very young.
Okay.
But by the time I was, like, by the time the 90s come around, I'm, like, 12.
But hold on, but that means in 84, 85.
I'm listening to Fred Hammond.
They're not playing Michael Jackson in the house.
Well, we knew Michael Jackson. We knew the music, but it wasn't, like, really played at the house. No.
But, like, my parents, in 1984, my mom bought me a Michael Jackson watch that played Beat It. Like, you weren't getting that.
I had a Michael Jackson folder that I took to class, but mostly we were playing gospel music at home in the 80s. The 90s come around, I was like 12.
Right. We're the exact same. By the way, what month's your birthday?
December.
December 78.
Yeah.
And I'm July 79.
Okay.
Okay, so by the early 90s, now you're 11, 12 years old.
Yeah,
and
I'm allowed to listen to everything. And, you know, just started listening to hip hop then. Listened to a lot of like New Jack Swing, R&B, you know. And the all the boy groups, like the male R&B groups were coming out, like Boyz II Men. And
don't skip over the boys. You know, I know you were doing Die on My Heart.
Yeah, yes. You know, New Edition, Boyz II Men, Bell Biv DeVoe, you know, into Jodeci by the time high school was coming around. R. Kelly and Public Announcement.
Isn't it funny? Didn't you think
H-Town.
Of course. Didn't you think that, I remember thinking that Jodeci was so edgy.
Yeah.
Content-wise.
Yeah, because they were juxtaposed against Boyz II Men.
And they're saying, so you're having my baby.
Yeah.
Like, they were, was already, there was a real hip-hop feel to them.
Yes, yes.
And at the time, I was like, whoa, they're talking about sex and having kids. This is kind of crazy.
It was like real R&B, like, in the sense of, like, talking about real life situations, not putting a lot of gloss on it.
Is there anything from that time that's, like, absolutely your favorite, or is it all just sort of stuff you
Well, want? I loved all that. If you play any of those groups I just named right now, if you played, like, a mix of that, it would take me back to
What do you think is the number one Jodeci record?
Ooh.
Because I think at the time
I used to love the remix to
Come and Talk to Me.
And I used to love the remix to Every Freaking Night.
Freaking You.
Yeah.
With Raekwon and Ghostface.
Yes.
But that came a little later, but those are the two best ones.
Yes.
But like,
I used to love all those remixes, though.
It started with Forever My Lady and Stay.
So those were the songs when I sang with other guys when I was in high school. When we would do talent shows, we would try to mock those songs. So we would do Forever My Lady, we would do Come and Talk to Me, Stay. We was like trying to be Jodeci.
Did you like Boyz II Men too, or were they like kind of overly poppy?
We
liked
them too. So we would do It's So Hard to Say Goodbye also, you know. But when Jodeci came around, it was like it made you not want to listen to Boyz II Men as much.
Isn't it funny?
Yeah.
It's funny to get into a conversation about like which R&B is softer.
Exactly.
Like, it's like Boyz II Men was so...
Yeah,
like, I loved them. They were great. They were part of our lives.
Yeah.
But Jodeci hit more.
Yeah, when Jodeci came in, you felt it in your gut more. Yeah.
And hip-hop-wise, like, were you becoming a straight-up head?
No, I wouldn't say that. I didn't really become more like really into hip hop until I was probably like 16, 17.
And who was that musically? Hip hop of you? Was it Tribe?
It was Tribe. It was like, so I'm in college. I'm in
Philadelphia. At UPenn.
Yeah, in Philadelphia at UPenn.
You get a ride to go there? Do you get a scholarship?
Yeah, I got a scholarship.
And for grades or music or both? Or
well, the way Penn works is they say it's all based on financial need, but then they threw in a little extra for academics. But everybody could get a scholarship there because just the fact you're getting into Penn means you have good grades and all
right.
that stuff. And so they basically base it off of what you can afford.
Okay.
And so we couldn't afford it, so they gave us a lot of money.
So you go to Philadelphia in 1997.
95.
Oh, because you were six.
Yeah.
I forgot. I'm sorry. I went in 97.
Yeah.
Damn, hold on. That's so bugged. Now that I realize
16.
We're the same age.
Yeah.
When you started high school, I was, of course, normal. And I was still in like sixth grade, seventh grade. So you started college in 95.
Yes.
Okay. So you go to
Philadelphia. I go there in a really interesting time for Philadelphia because the Roots.
Right in the middle.
Were like running neo soul music and hip hop. And so D'Angelo's coming through there, Common's coming through, you know, Erica's coming through, Bilal is coming out of there, Music Soul Child, Jaguar, all these people are doing all the open mics, Jill Scott, and I'm going to school there. And so I wasn't really known to them at that time, but I was there. I was there watching.
And what were you doing? Were you making music?
I was in school. I was singing in an a cappella group at school. I was making my own solo music on my own and working with Dave Tozer, this guy I worked with throughout my career. He worked on my last album, too. But we met in Philadelphia when I was in school. I played on Lauryn Hill's album back then when I was still in school, my junior year.
Wait, you played on
Played on Everything is Everything.
How did that happen when you're still in
school?
So
I was directing a church choir in Northeast PA every weekend. So I would go there, play on Sunday, and then go back to school. And one of the choir members was Lauren's friend. And
what was her name?
Her name is Tara Michelle. She grew up in Northeast PA and in Jersey,
okay.
near Lauren. And I think she went to Columbia High School, the same high school. And so they knew each other, and she would go back and forth to sing on Lauren's record, sing back up and just help with whatever.
Okay.
And she was like, Johnny, why don't you come with me to the session? And I'm like, oh, cool, you know.
Now, how aware of at the time, do you know the Fugees
of
well?
Of course, so the Fugees were huge.
Oh, they already had, we're already talking about it because it's her solo album. They'd already had the big
They
the
had Killing Me Softly and all that.
They were popping.
Yeah, so they played Penn Relays, I think, my freshman year. So they had already played on campus. They were huge.
What's Penn Relays?
Penn Relays is like
your big field, your
it's
day?
Like a big event, and it's like the black concert.
Got it.
So okay. They would have Spring Fling, which would be more white or mainstream.
Like Third Eye Blind played.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then they would have Penn Relays, which would be, and that year it was the Fugees headlining.
All right.
And Hove opening.
Of course. Makes perfect sense, by the way. People sounds crazy now.
Hove.
Makes perfect sense.
Hove got like kind of booed off the stage.
I'm about to say it must have been quiet for
like
them.
They didn't know who he was because he's like, this is Reasonable Doubt, right when it came out, and he wasn't very famous yet.
So I got to be honest, it's almost a slightly odd booking that they even had him opening.
Yeah, but the people were like, who is this clown? Like, and not that he was a clown performance
wise. They didn't know who he was.
They didn't know who he was. And they just looked at him like, okay, when we get
like,
to,
it would have
when
made,
do we hear Killing Me Softly?
Right, they would, it would have made more sense, frankly, to have like Common.
Yeah.
At the time, who's it's already post resurrection.
Yes,
then it would have made sense to have Hope. Okay, wow, I love stuff like that. So you go in there and who was in the studio when Lauren's doing this record?
The whole crew, like all the guys at Suter afterwards,
right? Jerry.
So Veda Nobles was there. Damien was there. I mean, not Damien, Rohan was there.
Yeah.
There was like a lot of weeds being smoked. Mm-hmm. It was like.
Was Clef
there? I don't think Clef was there.
Okay.
Clef was not there.
Oh, because they are already. It's weird for them.
They was already weird. Yeah.
Yep, got it.
That whole album was like the.
Yeah, if Rohan's there, that means Clef's
not
there.
Already like, it was like the breakup album.
I'm guessing Jerry. Was Jerry Wonder working?
I don't think Jerry was in there. It was James Poyser, I think, was there. Like,
and
if you read the credits. It was a lot of those cats sued her afterwards, but it was like that crew that was there.
So what do you actually end up playing on the
song? I played piano on Everything Is Everything.
I mean, the piano.
Yeah.
Dun,
dun, dun, dun.
That's the whole song.
That's me.
Wow.
Well, there was like a string part too, but
yeah,
I played the piano part.
Yeah. And what did you have a lawyer? Did you have a deal? Did you just do it for fun?
Well, I didn't write on it, so I just got a session fee. So
which
was adequate. Like that's what you were supposed to get.
But it still did it give you the early taste of when that song blew up a little bit? Like it must have given you that taste of me on the radio.
I used to tell people like I'm on track 13 on Lauryn Hill's album. I still remember the track number now.
Right, right.
Yeah, and that was like my claim to fame on campus. You know, so I go back my senior year. The album comes out in August. And I'm like stunting because I'm on Lauryn Hill's album, and that is the album everyone's listening to.
I mean, and for those who are somehow too young to remember, we're talking about sweeps the Grammys. It's the biggest thing.
It's the biggest story of the year in music.
Yes.
No question.
Hands down. Now, as a session player, you don't get a Grammy, though, right?
No, you get a check at the beginning. $500 is what I got.
Nice.
And a credit.
All right. That's still pretty good, though.
Yeah, it's
a good start.
It's fine.
So when does the next thing happen after you randomly stumble into that?
So I started working on my first demo right then. In 98, I was writing songs with a few producers and just trying to figure it out. I went in with Veda Nobles, who I met through the whole Lauryn situation. I wrote with this other guy named Dan Coleman, who was like a alumnus of a Penn and had connections in the business. I wrote with Dave Tozer, who I've been working with throughout my career now. And we were just writing and seeing what would happen. And we made my first demo and shopped it around. I got like a little bit of airplay in Philadelphia.
In Philly.
Yeah.
On the commercial
station? On WDAS.
Station. Okay. Yeah, what's WDAS?
It's like an R&B station.
Okay, okay. Like Urban AC kind of vibe?
Yeah, Urban AC. So that was my first airplay. And the music was kind of like Urban AC feeling. It was like a little bit trying to be like D'Angelo, a little bit like somewhere in a weird space between like Brian McKnight and D'Angelo.
Okay, okay, but I get it. And we skipped over Brian McKnight, who was also popping.
Oh yeah, he was. Yeah.
So that what song was it that made a little noise?
It's this song called "Is It All Right." You know, if you want to look online, you might
and
be able
it,
to
and
find
it. Created
it. It was under John Stevens, too.
Ah, under your real name.
Under my real name.
And so that creates a little, how much interest
did it create? Just the tiniest amount of buzz.
Enough to do anything?
Enough to meet with record labels
and
get turned down.
All right.
So
that's the first step, though, getting turned down.
Yeah. So that happened. And then the whole time, when I graduate school in 99, I get a management consulting job. So all my friends, you know, were interviewing with banks and management consulting firms, and I did it too. I was like, oh, I might as well. Even though I knew I wanted to do music, I was like, I might as well get a real job in the daytime so I can, you know, live. So I got a job, and I worked in Boston for the first year, and then I moved to New York in 2000. So I graduated in 99, moved to New York in 2000. I'm working as a consultant during the day, and at night I'm going to the studio and writing and trying to get this demo together, revise the demo because I got turned down the first time, work with new people, and I start doing gigs around New York. I play like SOBs, Jimmy's Uptown, Downtime,
and when you play,
Elbow Room, you know, all the little spots, Knitting Factory.
And what will you play when you play? Just your stuff? Like just
I would
songs?
Play. I would do covers, but I would also do my own stuff. And I had a little band that we put together. And I would play, and I would invite all my friends. Like, a lot of my friends from school moved to New York, so I would invite all of them. So I had, like, a guaranteed, like, 75 to 100 people that would show up to anything that I did.
Just to show love.
Yeah, just friends that were showing love.
And we're talking about 2000?
Yeah, 2000, 2001,
okay.
2002. I met Kanye in 2001. So Kanye was my roommate who went to Penn with me, his cousin. So my roommate's name is Devon. They started working together on Good Music, which was called Black Label for a second.
And what were they doing? What did Devon do?
Devon was just like A&R and helping out with whatever Kanye was doing on his label. So he was, you know, signing me.
Okay, so at the time, though, what else is he really doing? Like, he's making beats, obviously, already.
Yes.
And trying to get places.
So he's moving. He moved here from Chicago. And you remember the Blueprint came out in 2001.
Right.
And so he moved out here as the Blueprint recessions were happening.
And this is pre-meeting D-Dot? He's already met D-Dot.
Probably.
Okay.
And he already knew No ID in Chicago.
Right.
And then he comes out here and he starts being able to play records for Rockefeller. Okay. So he gets on Beanie's record and he gets on Jay's record.
Now, real quick, how well do you get to know him? Like, is he coming to New York? He's in New York all the time. So do you start seeing him all the time?
I think he was living here by then. So, but at first, I didn't know him when he was playing records for Rockefeller at first. I didn't meet him until after that happened.
Okay.
So I met him when his cousin was basically telling me, oh, he's about to be on Jay's next album, which came out on September 11th.
2001.
The day, you know.
And what's he like? What is a Kanye West in 2001 like? Because the stories you hear that even Syfe will tell is, you know, and he didn't know him probably until shortly after that, but that guy who always believed, almost to the point of being socially weird about it, that he was the shit, was very clear very early.
There. Yeah, he was already there.
And, like, was he letting everyone, like, were his visions big and grandiose
already? Yeah, and he already kind of carried that chip on his shoulder because everyone didn't take him seriously as a rapper. And to be honest, he wasn't that good rapping yet. You know, he got better as he got more experience.
But he had times where he's spitting bars for you and you're like, okay, all right.
Yeah, it wasn't all the way together yet.
But the beats already were good.
The beats were crazy, and his ideas were crazy. Like, his song ideas were crazy, and it was just as a rapper, he wasn't executing to the point where he was going to get eventually,
right,
I would say.
Of course, which makes sense.
Yeah. So he got better at rapping, but he already was a visionary. He was already, like, obsessed with dressing the freshest. He was already, like, artistically visionary, like, visually wise.
And enough of a visionary to convince you who, you know,
sign with him.
To sign. Yeah. And you're like, what are you even signing to?
Yeah. I was signing to a producer that was making dope beats for me.
Okay, got it.
And so he was making dope beats for me, and so my demo started to get better as I'm getting Kanye beats for it. And Used to Love You was on that demo, and, you know, Let's Get Lifted was on that demo. Songs that ended up on my first album.
Songs that ended up being real good songs.
Yeah, so they ended up being on that first album, and that was my demo in, like, 2002. And I got signed in early 2004 with Sony.
All right, hold on one second, John Legend. Ladies and gentlemen, I know this is an amazing episode, but real quick, I got to give a shout out to our friends at Loot Crate. Loot Crate is amazing, okay? If you are a geek like we are for many things, you know I am for hip-hop, wrestling, horror movies, so many different things, Syfe for comedy, movies, television, Loot Crate is the perfect thing for you. Basically, what it is it's a company that sends you an amazing box of amazing items, right? For the geek and gamer in you. For $20 a month, you get an incredible box of amazing stuff, all right? Plus, if you want to take it to another level, you can get a bigger box with Loot Crate DX. And I like DX. If you're more the type to wear geeky, you're geek on your sleeve, then Loot Wear, the monthly wearable and accessory subscription. It's incredible. Trust me, for the geek in you, and we know, 1F fans, we know what kind of geeks we are. We are cool, sometimes girlfriend and wife having geeks. But that said, we are passionate about the things we're passionate about, and that's why Loot Crate is perfect for you. Now, for October, Loot Crate is going all horror, okay? 40 years of creepy, campy, bloody icons in this month's crate, okay? I'm talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, all kinds of cool stuff, classics. I'm a Halloween guy myself also. You have until the 19th of this month at midnight Eastern time, 9 p.m. Pacific, to subscribe and get this month's crate. The 19th of October at 9 p.m. Pacific. That's midnight Eastern time, okay? So head to lootcrate.com and enter the code WANEP today to get an awesome discount on this monthly subscription. Lootcrate.com. Use the code WANEP. Now back to John Legend.
So did you start shopping this demo? Is he going to shop with you?
Yeah.
Oh, so he's...
So he's like, I want to sign you and help you get a deal. And so he started making the beats for me. I was singing on all of his College Dropout demos. And we're like, let's go. Let's do this. And he already had the deal with Rockefeller, but they weren't really prioritizing him as a rapper. I think they really just signed him so they would be closer to getting more of his beats.
Exactly. And he's still, of course, and that's what I love about his story. He's still like, no, I'm a rapper. And even Rockefeller's like, yeah, we know. We'll
Dame is like, I don't know. And Dame was like, Dame really didn't take him seriously as a rapper until after the accident, and he makes Through the Wire.
Right.
And then people are like, wow. And he made it on his own video with Cootie and Chike. And people are like, oh, wow, this is something's happening here.
Is he going to meetings with you and doing his Kanye selling of you?
Of me.
So you're sitting at meetings.
I'm like the next Stevie Wonder. He's saying all these amazing things about me.
Do you remember, did you meet with any people who you still know to this day, like big people who?
Yeah, definitely. And some of them remember it. And like, we'll have a little laugh. Like, yeah, I should have signed you.
Was it ever... Was it ever awkward when you're sitting there watching him put on the big show to try to sell you and you know he's selling
you? Well, I was going hard for myself, too. So I was like, I was selling myself, too. But, yeah, man, I mean, that's what you had to do. I always tell people you have to have audacity to be an artist because you're basically saying what I have to offer is better than what other people have to offer.
That's a great word.
I'm special. People need to hear me. So you have to have a bit of audacity to even assert that to anybody.
Yeah, so that's a great word choice, particularly when you talk Kanye.
Yeah.
He's like the king of audacity.
Yeah.
But every once in a while.
But you have to have it.
Right. Well, here's the funny thing. Someone was talking about Kanye the other day to me, and I said, I have met other people who, over the last 10 years being on the radio, who believe in themselves the way Kanye believes in Kanye. The problem is, 9 times out of 10, unfortunately, they're not very
good.
They're
not that good, but he's actually as good as he thinks he is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's socially weird. He's doing all these over-the-top things, but he's completely right.
Yeah,
like,
he's
great. Was completely right. He's as great as he said. So why did you end up going Columbia?
They made the best offer, and I like the legacy of the label. I think they've always been good with singer-songwriters, people that... are more than just a hit, They've always been good with that.
Well, it's funny. Nas said that signing to Columbia was a big deal for him. Like,
yeah.
he said, like, it was a big deal to be on the label Billy Joel was on, right? Like,
yeah,
it was
Bruce is there. John Mayer's there. There's, like, all these singer-songwriters there. And for me, I always saw myself as, even though I was coming through a hip-hop organization, and coming up with hip-hop producers, I always still saw myself as a singer-songwriter more than anything else. And so I thought it was a good label for someone like me. Maxwell was there.
Yeah,
the Fugees were there. Lauren was there. So I just felt like they would get me and they would figure it out.
Now, once you make that decision that you're going to go there, what's the next step? Is this album close to done?
It's already close to done because all the records that would have been on the album pretty much were written. With the notable exception of Ordinary People, which wasn't written until after I got signed, and which ended up being the biggest hit from the album. But everything else was pretty much written before.
So that's basically the only add-on was Ordinary People.
Yeah, and I wrote that with will.i.am. So I happened to be managed by David Sonnenberg at the time, who was the Black Eyed Peas manager. He was originally Clef and the Fugees manager as well. And
which is how you know him?
No, I knew him just through my lawyer.
Who's your lawyer?
Aaron Rosenberg.
Oh, my cousin, of course. No.
Of course. What's funny, though, is he went to high school with Devon, the same person that was Kanye's cousin. Yeah, so Devon introduced me to my lawyer and Kanye.
So Devon, let's just be clear.
MVP.
Devon's key, a major key to the John Legend story.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
Shout out to Devon.
Yes. He lives here in New York. He's got his own business. He's doing his thing. He introduced me to my lawyer in 2001, and my lawyer introduced me to David Sonnenberg, and I signed with him in 2002, and we started working together, and one of the first people he put me with was will.i.am, because...
Who's popping at the time.
Who was...
Second album, I think, probably.
They hadn't put out Where's the Love yet.
Right. No, this is...
So they were more straight-up hip-hop.
Joints and Jams.
Yeah, Joints and
Jams.
That
was their biggest moment so far.
Yeah, exactly.
Was Joints and Jams.
So they were more like kind of like backpack-ish, like fun dance... Hip hop, but not like pop.
No, this was a time for people who don't remember when, like, Black Eyed Peas, the group that they were most associated with. If iTunes had existed then, the group most associated with them would have been like Jurassic 5.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where they were.
Dilated People.
Dilated, right? Yeah. That was the space they lived in.
Yeah.
But Will is a friggin' genius. So it links you up with will.i.am.
Yeah, and so we wrote "She Don't Have to Know." That was the first song we wrote together, and then we eventually wrote Ordinary People. And the Ordinary People session was a Black Eyed Peas session where he was asking me to write hooks for the Black Eyed Peas. And I ended up saying, let me take this hook back. I want to use this for my own song.
And he was cool.
And he was cool with it. He was just like, let me produce it. But then by the time I did the piano demo, everyone was like, oh, the piano demo is all you need. And so we ended up just putting out the piano demo.
How crazy is it that is Ordinary People your biggest?
All of Me is the biggest now. But
All of Me is the biggest.
Up until then, it was Ordinary People and then Green Light and then All of Me.
How weird is it to you that Ordinary People is like in the conversation your biggest record and it's a straight up just piano and you singing?
Yeah.
Like that being a pop hit in the era in which it was.
But it wasn't really a pop hit. People think it was bigger than it was.
Really?
All of Me went to number one on the pop chart, on every chart,
on
the Hot 100. Ordinary People didn't get past, it didn't get to the top 20.
What about in Urban?
In Urban, it was top five.
Didn't make number one though.
I don't know if it was number one, but it was right up there.
You know what it feels
like? Urban AC and Rhythm, it did well, but it never really crossed.
It's funny, too, because you're right. When I think of Ordinary, I'm not kidding. For some reason, I have a memory of literally hearing Ordinary People in a department store.
Yeah.
Like, it was playing everywhere.
Playing a lot of places, but it was not playing on pop radio.
But that song resonated because literally the content matter was so real.
It was real. It was people really felt, you know, I was speaking directly about what they were going through.
When do you go out on the road and start like the, you said you went on the road with Kanye.
Yeah.
So we started
going on the road in 2003, right before, the College Dropout came out in February of 2004. So we started going out on the road right before then.
And my guess is that, and were you opening for him or just playing with
him? I was playing with him, and I would open some of the shows, too.
Oh, by the way, so you were definitely at the show, the first Kanye show I was ever at, which
I'm sure.
My group opened for him.
Oh.
I'm sure everyone has that story. Not the one I was in. Don't worry. It's just my people. At University of Maryland.
Oh, yeah.
You were definitely there,
I was
right?
there. I was there.
Yeah, like, it was like there. The... Which ballroom was it?
I know. I remember the ballroom.
It was upstairs. Colony Ballroom, I think.
Yeah.
And so you were along the ride for all that. Now,
all of that. I was on the road with him all the way through when my album was about to come out. We were opening for Usher. My album came out in December of 2004. His came out in February of 2004. So he's opening for Usher on the Confessions tour in the late summer, early fall of 2004.
So in that original run where you're doing a lot of college campuses, et cetera, mm-hmm. and really the biggest records, Through the Wire and
Slow Jams
now, and all the College Dropout songs eventually,
yeah.
Workout Plan.
All Falls Down, Workout Plan.
Who was the core unit of you guys?
It was me, GLC, Consequence, Ye, and Don C, and Iben.
And what was Don C tour? He was DJing?
He was tour manager and DJ.
And DJ. And now, was
DJ Offbeat, I believe it was.
And was Don playing DJing or just instant replay?
It was instant replay.
So he was just the instant replay DJ, yeah. And also making sure everyone was doing what they had to do.
Yeah, and make sure the bus was on time. And all. You know,
how
all
were the looking back, how were those shows? Were they good shows?
I mean, they were what they were, you know.
They were playing joints.
They weren't that polished. And Don's not a real DJ, et cetera, et cetera. DJ, now I'm like, who is our DJ for the Usher tour?
Plain Pat. A-Track.
Yeah, A-Track.
That's when A-Track gets on.
A-Track.
Board.
How could I not think of his name?
It's all good.
Now?
He's too famous to remember.
We were on the bus all the time together. So A-Track joined us for the Usher tour, but up until then it was Don C.
And you're playing keys?
I'm playing keys and singing all
and
the
singing.
Hooks. Yeah.
And how is Kanye already the perfectionist Kanye, like getting crazy and being like, yo, we need to do blah, 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 this could be better? Or,
yeah, he's pretty close. But he was a little mellower then, and I think he became, I think, even more Kanye later, but he was already on the way.
And how did you guys interact, the two of you? Because, like, he obviously has a great respect for your talent.
Yeah, he always respected me, but obviously we have different personalities, but we always got along really well. And he was always a good producer for me because his point of view is different than mine, but when we worked together, it worked out very well.
And who else did you get to? Do you remember? Are there any relationships from the very early touring days of people you remember getting to do shows with? Like, sometimes people go on the road and it's random people you realize you've been connected to for 15 years and really
yeah.
you opened a show together.
I mean, I remember everybody. Like, Kweli was around a lot, Mos, Common. These are all people that were in our circle that we were spending a lot of time with. Chappelle, we did Chappelle's show a couple times. And, you know, it was like that was a lot of the crew.
And at what point do you?
We did his block party and BK.
What a moment that was.
Yeah.
At what point do you start like popping? Where like it's like,
well,
okay.
Ordinary People was a huge hit, and it, you know, relatively speaking, and it started popping in December of 2004.
And at that point, people start recognizing you. And
I knew I was
change.
Famous the day I got a call from Magic Johnson and Oprah on the same day.
Okay. Take me through this day.
So I'm going around New York, and my agent is like, Magic wants to talk to you.
All right.
I'm going to give him your number. So Magic calls. He's like, can you play this charity event I'm doing?
What's up, John?
Yeah, exactly.
It's me, Irvin.
Yeah. So he calls. And mind you, I was like the biggest Magic L.A. Lakers fan growing up in the 80s.
Okay.
Like huge. And so this is like one of my favorite people on the planet.
Yeah, because remember, you're growing up in Ohio. Being a hardcore Cleveland Cavaliers fan was not yet a thing that really existed.
Yeah, you weren't like Brad Daugherty. Yes.
I'm the world's biggest Craig Elo fan.
Larry Nance. The original Larry Nance.
The original Larry Nance.
Yes.
So what does he say he wants from you?
He wants me to come and play at a charity event for his foundation. Then Oprah calls the same day.
What does that mean? So your agent calls you again and is
and
like,
says,
yo, I know
Oprah
this is
wants
crazy.
To speak to you. Yes.
Now, real quick, in your mind, right now, if you were to tell people, I met two people. And I met Oprah and I met Magic Johnson. In 2016, in my opinion, Magic gets kind of like passed over and people are like, oh my God, you met Oprah.
Yeah,
but
Oprah,
at that
Oprah's
time,
still a god. And Magic is a god to the people that grew up watching basketball
exactly.
during that era.
But at that time, what were you more excited about? Magic or Oprah?
Well, Oprah, because everybody knew that if Oprah liked you and put you on the show,
you could be out of here.
Yeah.
So what does she say?
She says, can you come play at this thing I'm doing called the Legends Weekend, which aptly named for me.
Of course, exactly.
And she was honoring like 50 black women that were like super important and influential to her, from, you know, Ruby Dee, Nancy Wilson to
Angela Davis.
Yeah, like everybody.
Right.
Chaka Khan, Aretha, like all these amazing, Whitney. Like, all these amazing women are there. Janet, all at her estate in Montecito near Santa Barbara.
Wow.
So they're all there. She asked me to come perform for them, and I do.
Now, up till this point, who's the most, like, famous people you'd been around up until this time? Like, it's got to just be, rap artists, right? Like, people you
mostly,
admired, but
not
worldwide superstars.
Well, Usher, you know, like.
Oh, because Confessions, you got to be around Usher, too.
Yeah.
And he was a huge star at the time.
Yeah, he was Matt.
He wasn't Oprah, but he was a huge star.
That was the biggest album of the year.
Yeah,
Confessions was
And it's still
massive.
A
month. Yeah.
10 million copies sold.
Yeah, it was huge.
But what is it like to be in that room where you see Janet Jackson?
It was insane. And they were singing along to Ordinary People. Like, I'm like, wow, these people know my song.
and the song's such a unique sounding song, and you have a unique voice too.
Yeah.
And it's funny, interesting hearing that you did theater, because that is a song, as many are, where you can hear your sort of theater chops are sort of part of your so that's an insane experience. Now, I have to ask you, just because it comes to my head, because you mentioned Janet. You did have time in which you crossed over and both having a career, so I have to ask, did you ever have a Michael Jackson story?
Yeah, I met him.
Okay, so tell me about
in Bahrain.
Please tell me.
He was living in Bahrain, and he was kind of hiding out because I think he had been through like the lawsuits and all the controversy with the, you know, all the controversies he had.
Of course.
And he was getting, you know, he was just tired of being in America, so he's hiding out in Bahrain. And I got invited there for a celebrity Formula One event, and they were like, by the way, you know, Michael's living here, so you probably get to meet him if you come. I was like, okay.
That's amazing, too. So they know, basically, that since Michael's there, if something cool is happening, he'll likely show up.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's in Bahrain. So,
yeah,
like,
it's like a island nation. It's small.
So, yeah. So there's a poppin' thing with American music.
Yeah.
And you know, like, okay. So you're like, oh.
Michael comes to this event. We sit at the same dinner table. It's me, the Crown Prince, a few other celebrities. Tyson, I think, was there.
Mike.
Beckford.
Oh, Beckford, okay.
Who Kid was there randomly.
All right. You know, stop the story. I can refuse to accept that Who Kid was there.
Who Kid was there? I swear to God he was there.
Yo, by the way, this is why we need Who Kid on the podcast. We never had Who Kid on the podcast. Okay, we'll ask him how the fuck he ended up there. But
All right.
So hold on, you look up and Michael's sitting at the table with you.
Yeah, we just start talking. We talk about music, we talk about travel, we talk about just life. Talk about the business, you know.
Was there anything in particular that he said that like jumps out at you, or is it just like a general great moment, or is there like any specific
stuff? I don't remember
stuff?
Any like specific nuggets. It was like I was just amazed that he knew who I was, and we were just talking.
Did his voice? Okay, I'm sorry, I have to ask a nitty gritty question. What was his voice like in person?
It was kind of like, it wasn't as high pitched as you might think sometimes, but it was still relatively high pitched. But he just talks kind of low,
not as exaggerated though as people would make it out to be.
Yeah, and it was like he's just a quiet talker. He doesn't talk very loud at all.
Is that a pinch me moment though, where you're like, how the fuck did I end up here? Like I'm in Bahrain.
It's crazy.
Sitting with Michael Jackson and Who Kid, for God's sake. How did I make it?
What's going on?
Now, have you had a recent one? What about before I let you go, got to hear a little bit about Obama. You've had multiple
experiences.
We've had
some good Obama moments.
What's that like?
Well, they're as cool as you think they are. They really are. They're like super, they know pop culture well, like they know us, they know the music we know, pretty much. I mean, they're not as deeply in it.
Yeah, they're talking about a little Uzi Vert.
Yeah, but like they know what's going on, and they're just cool. They're like comfortable in their own skin, and it's like you feel cooler just being around them, because they're like, and Michelle is like the coolest, like, Mrs. Obama, I love her.
All right, she's just dumb cool. Like that's what she seems like.
Like she's like just great.
So, real quick, what do you aspire to do now? After a run like this, what is there out there?
I just want to keep making great music. Like I want to be better at what I do. Every show I want to be better than it was before. Every album, every song. Like I'm always thinking like I can get better.
Is there anything you have a chip on your shoulder about? Like, I need to do blank. Like, I didn't win Album of the Year yet.
I would love to win Album of the Year. I would love to win Song of the Year. But, you know, I figure just create the best content you can and everything else will figure itself out.
So you don't get caught up in – at someone at your level, do you ever get caught up, like, sitting there – and this is a tough question to answer because I know on the surface, like, of course not. I'm John Legend, goddammit. But, like, do you ever have a moment where you end up looking at your peers at what they're doing, like, fuck, why aren't I doing that? Or do you get to a point where you're completely past that and your ego does not require that?
No, it's not really. I don't think about it like I'm in competition with anybody, though. I never think about.
Although, oddly enough, you're kind of in your own lane. You're really not in competition.
Yeah, it's not really other artists that are exactly me. You know, there's like artists that have some elements of this, some elements of that. But like I'm in my own lane. And even if there was somebody else in my lane, I don't think people buy music like that. They're like, oh, I can only listen to one artist of that lane. Like,
it's a very good point.
They're streaming. First of all, they're listening to whatever they want to listen to. And all you have to do is make something compelling for them to listen to, and they'll listen to it. And so you don't have to make it so that they'll listen to you and not Frank Ocean, or you and not Maxwell, or you and not Miguel. Like, you can listen to both of us.
Yeah,
like,
it's very true. Like, it's interesting because in radio competition, you know, like you're competing with people. It's like, well, they have a choice. I want to listen to this one or that one at that time.
Yes.
But
when it comes to fans wanting albums, they want you because they love you as an artist. And if they love another artist that's, you know, roughly similar to you, then that's fine too.
Yeah, I guess that works out. Hey, John, tell them real quick the name of your new album.
New album's called Darkness and Light. The new single's out right now. It's called Love Me Now. And you can get that now. The album. The label is being very coy about the release date, but it's going to come in December.
You don't get to just tell them, like, nah, I want to do this date.
Well, it's a conversation, and it's a marketing decision because the album's done.
And real quick, and you have Chance the Rapper on the album.
Chance is on there, Brittany Howard from the Alabama Shakes, and Miguel.
I'm very excited about that, man. You always for those who listen to Juan Epstein and obviously are fans of the music but wouldn't get to necessarily be around it, you are one of the coolest, most regular guys you could ever see. Considering, I always get the impression also, do you ever have the experience that you are like this super famous guy? You have your wife is super famous. Yeah. You're both, as a couple, you're famous. So it's like a trifecta of famous.
But at the same time, you're very close with Kim and Kanye. So are there ever moments, because I have this as someone who in some parts of my life, I'm kind of famous.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm with Childish Gambino, and no one gives a shit when they see me. Do you ever have moments when you're with Kim and Kanye where it's like, as famous as you are, it's nice that you don't live quite in what their world is?
Theirs is beyond ours, and it's pretty intense. And for the practical reality is it means more paparazzi are following them everywhere they go.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's ever a feeling like, oh, I wish that we had that happen.
Yeah, we don't need more paparazzi. We have enough.
You have plenty of bullshit to deal with.
So, like, they're just, like, just a bit more famous than us, and that extra bit is, like,
it's significant. It's enough in terms of, especially given the recent events, which, of course, sending love out to Kanye and Kim. Yeah. Just so much extra stress and bullshit. Yo, John, you're a great guy. Very excited about the album. Thanks
Such
for taking
a pleasure,
time.
Brother.
John Legend, ladies and gentlemen.